From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Here's a scenario. You've just published a wildly successful cookbook. How do you duplicate that success on TV? Well, you might ask Samin Nosrat.
You know, and I'm like dropping my tissues and like it's just... and I'm like, well, this is good TV at least.
Samin Nosrat is one of my favorite chefs and cooking teachers. Last year, she published her first cookbook titled Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Written for cooks of all skill levels, it wasn't a typical how-to. Instead, Samin sought to explain the building blocks of flavor, the fundamentals that lead to great dishes. The book was a New York Times bestseller and racked up a bunch of awards, including the James Beard for General Cookbook. It was such a hit that Netflix decided to turn it into a show.
I felt very strongly like this might be my only shot, so what do I want to do with it, you know? I want to make something different.
Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat is a four-part docuseries, part travel show, part cooking instruction, but 100% Samin.
The single most important element to good cooking is salt. When you perfectly season something, it zings in your mouth. I don't really ever follow recipes. So to me, tasting is the only way to know. I start with some, and I taste it, and I decide if I want to add a little bit more.
Like her book, it's already earning rave reviews, not only for its gorgeous visuals and practical wisdom, but for reshaping our ideas about food TV. Buongiorno, Samin.
Buongiorno, Evan.
Come stai?
Sto nerviosa. Nervosa?
So we're on radio. We're not on television, so there's no subtitles. So are you shocked by the reception?
I'm overwhelmed. I wouldn't say shocked. I mean, I'm shocked by the sheer amount of it, I guess, and the fact that it seems to be universally positive and the way that it's landed with people. I mean, I get emails every day. The thanks are overwhelming.
And what are they thanking you for?
All different things. Thanks for getting my kids in the kitchen with me. I mean, the most moving email by far that, like, I wept and then I sent it to everyone at Netflix and they all wept was from a woman who sent it maybe less than 24 hours after the show went up. And she said, it was a very matter-of-fact email. It didn't even have, like, a hello. It just said, I assume you're getting a lot of emails for your fantastic show. No need for response. I brought my daughter home the other day after 11 days in the psychiatric ward. She was diagnosed with bipolar psychosis. She's essentially bedridden and nonverbal. We're tinkering with her meds. We watched the first two episodes of the show yesterday. This morning, she woke up and made pesto with a mortar and pestle and a homemade pizza. It was everything I could do to keep my tears back. You are a profound light. And then she looked at me and she said, I really like her because even though she's been cooking for 18 years, she doesn't lecture. She asks questions.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, God.
I'm like, yeah,
I felt this family's pain and feelings and joy. And I was like, wow, that a cooking show can do this?
But it's not a cooking show. It's you. And I think what's so interesting about Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, the cooking show, is it shows us how far we've come in order to finally have a regular person who is not manufactured for television, who is themselves 100% and happens to also be unbelievably smart and super accomplished. The fact that you were able to do that, go through the production process, where here in Hollywood we know that that isn't always so, is really extraordinary.
It's so funny because I'm like, oh, I have a job. I'll just do my job. Like, you know, I'm given an opportunity. I'll just figure out how to do it. And I do think that there was a lot of, like, being thrown at me in the beginning, oh, you're a natural. Like, you were made for this. And I didn't really compute. I didn't really understand what it meant. And only after a while, you know, actually I was filming one day before we started production on the show. We were still in pre-production, but I did a little one day video with my friend Daniel Klein, who has the Perennial Plate. Mm-hmm. And he was like, Samin, I always forget. You're such a natural. And I was like, Daniel, everyone keeps saying that. What does it mean? And he said, it's just because you're the same when the cameras are on and when the cameras are off. And there's some way where it doesn't phase you. And that's really rare. And I was like, it is? You know, because to me, I was like, why would I change if there's cameras there? It just didn't even occur to me to change. And so I guess that's a special skill. And then, you know, there were a lot of other things that I learned throughout the process. It was definitely like immersive learning. But there are a lot of things that are very similar to TV production from cooking, from working in a restaurant, you know? And it felt very second nature to me in a lot of ways.
The show, the first episode is on fat. Not salt, which surprised me. And I was just shocked that it was Italy, that the fat you chose was olive oil. And the context of that was the food culture of Italy. That was fascinating to me.
Well, you know, the beauty of this idea is that it's universal. And so we went through so many different countries trying to piece together a production, you know, based on schedule and budget and who we knew where. But also based on my story, and since the beginning, I had always associated Italy with fat because of the olive oil and because it was really where I learned about olive oil. And also I worked with Dario Cecchini, the butcher, and that was where I learned, you know, I learned a lot about pork fat there. At one point, we considered Italy for salt, to go to Sicily and do like the trapanese salt and anchovies and capers, but just scheduling-wise, it didn't work out. And so I was really happy to do olive oil. It's such a sort of foundational fat for me in my cooking. And I think for a lot of people, there's a lot to learn about it. So I was really pleased to do that. And in terms of putting it first, that wasn't, that was Netflix. They just were, I think they loved that episode so much.
Yeah, it's visually stunning. And also the fact that the light hasn't been shown on Liguria like it has been on Tuscany or Lazio, where Rome is, for example.
Yeah, and again, like, Ligurian olive oil has always been my favorite. So to me, I knew I wanted, I was like, I want to do this. It was very fun in a lot of ways. I was like, if we're going to Italy, we have to do Parmesan cheese. We have to do Ligurian olive oil. We have to do a butcher in Tuscany, you know.
And did you say, and I have to be able to speak in Italian? Because within the first few minutes, I'm like listening to you speak Italian and I'm reading the subtitles and I keep waiting for it to switch over and it doesn't. There was something about sort of your naturalness and the authenticity of that that I found very synergistic.
What was funny was I don't think we planned to do it in Italian. It had been 13 years since I'd been to Italy. So I was surprised by how much I remembered. You know, I try to watch movies in Italian. I still, you know, visit with Dario when he comes and he doesn't speak a word of English. So I've had like maybe 3 times a year I practice speaking my Italian. I was really surprised how much I remembered, but we immediately landed and it just came back to me. And once I started doing it, they were like, yeah, let's go with this. I mean, I think there was a lot that we were figuring out as we went along, and that was just one of the first things. But yeah, it didn't make sense not to. I mean, yeah. It's also a lot faster because then a translator, yeah, I don't have to wait for a translator, and then the scene keeps going. Like, we don't start and stop, and it lets everybody be more natural if I can just speak to them.
But you toured Japan, and that's all about salt. Talk to me about your relationship with that country and its food. Was that also an obvious decision?
In my mind, so originally in the very first, like, sort of treatments that we were making and envisioning the show, I wanted to go to multiple countries per episode because, again, to prove the point that wherever you go, these things keep showing up. So I really wanted to go to Bolivia to visit those huge salt flats there. And I also wanted to go to Japan to demonstrate, oh, this is a culture that uses salt in all of these different ways, every single day, every single dish. But I had never been to Japan. I don't really know anything about Japanese cooking. I have many friends. There's kind of a beautiful sisterhood between a group of Japanese chefs and a group of Bay Area chefs. So we've had an exchange going on for many years, and I knew Yuri through that, and I knew a bunch of other folks in Japan through that. But it was definitely one where I was like, teach me everything because I don't know anything about this. And yeah.
So I have to ask you sort of a bizarre side question here. There's a yellow pot, which makes an appearance at Nancy Hachisu's house outside of Tokyo. And that pot reappears with your mother in the last episode at your house.
I know, it's so funny. So so many people have commented. They're like, did you travel with this pot across an ocean? We happen to have the same pot. It's those Dansk Coben style like pots. I got mine on eBay, and Nancy, I think, you know, got hers 30 years ago. And so many people are like, where'd you get that pot? It's amazing. And I'm like, you can buy them on Amazon or eBay.
I have to tell you that I grew up with one of those pots, and never did I see my mother use the lid as a trivet. I can't believe this is how I'm learning about it. Throughout the show, you're constantly asking questions of people. But when I was watching the Japan episode, I thought to myself, were these questions scripted or did you literally not know? And so you just were asking questions wherever you were.
I'm always asking questions, so that's definitely part of it. Caroline Soo, my director, is a really avid eater. She's of Korean descent, and the Korean word for like someone who likes to eat is mokpo. And the Farsi word for someone who likes to eat is shekamu. So those are like nicknames for each other. But she's not a professional cook. You know, she's not a food professional. So she had a lot of sort of layperson questions. And she was really good at feeding them to me. But there were a lot where I didn't know, you know, especially in Japan and in the Yucatan, there were a lot of things I didn't actually know. And also I understood that it's my job to sit in, you know, to stand in for the viewer and ask the questions that they might not know. And one thing I had, I'm definitely on like a human journey still, but, you know, I grew up in a family and in a culture and in a time where to me, to admit that I didn't know something was really embarrassing, right? Because I wanted to prove how smart and special I was. I've kind of come around, and now I'm okay with being like, what's that? Or the other day I was in an interview with somebody really like intellectual, and he used a word I didn't know, and I was like, I don't know what that means. You have to define it for me. So I'm getting better at just being like, I don't know what that thing is. Teach me. And I feel like that's a thing you don't get to see a lot on TV, and I feel like if I can be a little bit fearless and not worried about being embarrassed, then maybe that will help you be a little bit more fearless and not worried about being embarrassed.
The other part of the show, which is extraordinary, is the focus that you put on women and the way they come into the show as a host or a chef or a nonna. And this idea of women in the foreground, was that intentional?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I also think it has to be intentional in a world where the natural pull of the media is not toward home cooks or toward women. And so precisely because of that, I made it our mission. Again, from the very first treatments, going back and forth with Jigsaw, the production company, I was constantly like course correcting. And then eventually we all got on the same page and they were like, oh, some of you won't like this, which was great. You know, like that they understood. And it didn't take a lot for me to convince anyone why I wanted to do it. I think it's just a thing I've been paying attention to, you know, the food landscape and food media for a long time. And I have been acutely aware of what's missing. And I felt very strongly like this might be my only shot. So what do I want to do with it? You know, I want to make something different.
Let's take a quick break. In a moment, more of my conversation with Samin Nosrat. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I've been talking with Samin Nosrat about her new Netflix show, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Let's talk about the Yucatan. Every single episode had its own super engaging beauty, and that, of course, was all about acid. It was just blew my mind. The honey thing blew my mind.
The honey is crazy. I mean, obviously, I knew it was more acidic. You know, going there, I was like, oh, I'm going to taste this honey that's more acidic. It was completely genuine, like the expression on my face, the reaction I had to tasting it, which was, I mean, it tastes like honey lemonade. It's this Melipona honey that comes from these Melipona bees, which are a really ancient kind of stingerless bee that for, I think, 3,000 years these bees have had a relationship with the people of the Yucatan because since they don't have stingers, they don't have natural defenses. So they really rely on humans. It's a symbiotic relationship. And the humans protect them from predators and help them build these hives that have all these like mazes and all these other defense mechanisms that are, you know, not stingers. And then the humans get this honey, which has all of these incredible characteristics, like some which I think have been assigned and some which are natural things like maybe it's a little bit more antibacterial. It's a little bit medicinal, has like almost mystical characteristics.
And is sometimes transparent.
Oh, it's very light in color. It's very, very light in color and it's very thin. And I mean, on the show, you see they harvest it with a syringe, like because a typical beehive produces anywhere from 20 to 30 liters a year, I think. And a Melipona hive has 1 to 2. And so it's very precious and hence very expensive. I was really excited. We found this community through our food producer, this incredible woman, Nikki Nakazawa, who has had a pop-up in Mexico for 10 years, and she had worked with Rene Redzepi when he was there, like helping source mezcals, and she had worked on Dave Chang's Ugly Delicious episode down there. And so she connected us to this organization, the Tres Patios Maya. They are just doing this incredible work to support indigenous populations. And so for me, it was a great opportunity to taste this incredible thing, but also to highlight these people who have historically been so disenfranchised. And in doing so, hopefully get them some attention and some money. You know, like maybe we can create a market for this honey for them.
And also all those Seville oranges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to say that watching that episode made me want to have in our market, you know, come on.
You have everything.
We have everything. And yet, it's so brief.
Mm-hmm.
It's brief and rare that we get sour oranges.
Yeah, we get them in Northern California for about maybe 6 weeks, like December to early February.
Yeah.
And
if your show could just make that a bit more diffuse.
Yeah. I mean, already I've gotten messages from people. I have a friend who's like, I want to start a company that harvests all of the sort of fallen fruit from the sour orange trees and create sour orange juice, you know, products. And I was like, do it. I was like, you now have a global market for it.
The women that you were cooking with down there in the Yucatan were so generous and patient. The scene where you're making the tortillas.
Oh my God, they were going to kill me. They were not having it. I mean, they were amazing. So that family, they live still in the like pre-colonial way. They live on a milpa, you know, and they grow their three sisters. And this mother, her brood all lives on this piece of land with her in these tiny little like huts, basically. Typically, she grinds her own corn every day, but her mill was down. And so that was why we went down to the like town Molino. But yeah, they were very not impressed by me or the production or like my lack of tortilla skills or the fact that I just kept cracking up.
When you asked her how many tortillas she made a day.
Yeah.
240.
Yeah, 250 or something a day. Like she just, because she has to feed all these. There's like 17 or 18 people who live there. And over the course of a day, each one will eat 10 tortillas, you know. And she just was like, you're some chef coming from some other country and you can't even make one tortilla, right? You know? She was not impressed.
So that laugh, we hear it a lot in the show, sometimes with tears at the same time, like the habanero salsa.
Oh my God, it was so spicy. You know, and that's a whole other thing that was so funny was became a joke on the show, like what a terrible actress I am. I can't fake anything skills. And so if we knew that I needed to be surprised by something or have a hello, like a genuine hello with somebody for the first time, they learned pretty quickly that they had to segregate me, you know, and so that, like keep me separate to make sure that we could capture the original hello because I wasn't going to be able to redo it 10 times because I just don't have it in me. And so there was also, so that's one part of it is like I'm a terrible actress. And part of it is I just have this mind that's going on all the levels at once. So I'm doing the thing. I'm doing whatever I'm doing for the camera. as a storyteller and a journalist, I'm thinking, like, is this making a good story for the audience? And then also I'm very aware that there's all of these people here and this, like, you know, 20 people standing and looking and the multiple cameras and directors and producers and all this kind of stuff. And so I was having a very meta experience going into the salsa because I could tell just as they were making it, the entire space, it was kind of this covered market. We were all weeping because it was so spicy. We couldn't really even breathe. We were all coughing. And I knew it was going to be spicy. So I took a bite and it was this thing where I took a bite and it was so incredibly spicy that tears came to my eyes.
It's so spicy. It's so spicy.
I told you. Drink some beer. You okay?
I'm going to cry. That was really too stupid of me. And I'm having this, like, calculation in my head, like, I'm being recorded, there's tears coming in my eyes, I'm wearing a little bit of eye makeup, and, like, I also know I'm going to still have to eat 10 more bites of this, most spiciest thing that I've ever eaten in my life. So I'm, like, I'm just cracking up at the absurdity of it all, you know? You know, and I'm, like, dropping my tissues, and, like it's just... And I'm, like, well, this is good TV, at least.
Well, it's good TV because they decided to leave it in.
Yeah, totally.
So a couple times throughout the show, the concept of wabi-sabi is mentioned. Talk to me about what that means.
Man, I should have done my homework. Okay, so what I believe it means is sort of the imperfection of humanity. You know, I think a lot of different cultures have this idea. I know in some Native American cultures, there's even, like, there'll be a weaving, and on the last, like, rung of the weaving, they'll do it imperfectly on purpose because the only gods and only, the perfect deities make things perfect. And so I had heard about it in the one example that I had heard about in Japan was of this master ceramicist who's been doing ceramics for, like, 60 years and can pick up a lump of clay and pull a bowl in, like, two movements, and it'll be perfect, and then he'll always just do a little tap to make sure that, you know, he's put his human touch on it. And I love that because, to me, there's nothing that I do that's perfect, you know? And, like, there's kind of, and yet I'm a perfectionist always striving for that. So it's kind of a little bit of a relief for me to be like, well, there's beauty in the, you know, in the flower arrangement with the, like, fallen leaf.
But what I think is interesting that you say you're perfectionist, in the result of your work, in the flavor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's many, like they say, there's many roads that lead to Rome.
Yeah.
And that's sort of your whole way of teaching.
Yeah, for sure. I'm after, like, that deepest, farthest, like, most delicious flavor, but there's so many ways to get there, and that's exactly right. And I'm always trying to show you that whatever, you can always make do with whatever you've got to get there. Also, as I've gotten deeper into the food world and deeper into cooking, for me, the food matters so much less. And so it's the experience of going to the market and bumping into people, or it's the experience of bringing a whole bunch of kids into my kitchen and they're tearing everything apart. But, like, I get this really fun day with them, and it's okay if the pasta we make is really ugly and half uncooked because it's kind of, like, uneven, because what did we get out of that? We got this amazing experience. And so I think my own values have shifted away from that product and more into the experience. And my hope is that that's really conveyed through the work.
Definitely. I have to tell you that yesterday, I mean, I was having, like, this really weird day of jet lag eating, which is just, like, a bunch of very disparate things sequentially.
I'm familiar.
And I was roasting a bunch of asparagus, and I put it in my little toaster oven, and I had the heads in first. And then I thought to myself, no, Samin was talking about how she puts the legs of a chicken to the back of the oven. And I said, well, this would be the same.
Totally.
For the bottoms of the asparagus or the tops of whole roasted carrots.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me such joy to experience this exchange between the two of us, even though you weren't there, from just something that you talked about.
I love that so much. I mean, when I was making the book, my friend Tamar Adler's book had come out a few years earlier, and I had so many friends, including myself, who read and loved that book, and there was a lot of, like, what would Tamar do? Or Tamar would tell me to do this. And so that became this thing that I aspired to do and to be, was your friend in the kitchen. If I could be so clear in my voice in the book that you could know what I would advise you to do, if I'm going to be the little, like, Jiminy Cricket, or my friend calls me Samini Cricket.
And that's, I don't think people understand how hard that is to do.
Yeah. And so that I feel like the show just helps that go to a whole other level. In fact, yesterday, another friend texted me, he said, oh, my husband's putting on the pasta water to boil. And he looked at me and he's like, well, Samin would probably say add 2 cups of salt now. I wrote back, I was like, maybe 3.
Yes, so you and your mom. You and your mom, what a fascinating juxtaposition.
Oh my gosh.
Not just temperamentally.
In every way.
In every way.
And then I'm going to put some saffron in.
The saffron is going to start giving some color and taste and smell to the tahdig. We try to make it into a heap. Then the steam is going to come from around it and it's going to be easier to cook.
And then this is my favorite part. You got to poke the holes all the way down to the bottom.
We let the steam come up.
So it's really just such a mild little sizzle in there.
Yes.
It's not very strong.
Not at all.
Apparently I've been doing this wrong my whole life.
You're not frying it. You're just making good crusty tahdig.
Okay.
What I loved about that segment was everything that was unsaid.
There was so much tongue biting.
For many of us who have mothers who are very opinionated.
And it was really funny, too, because there was this one moment where she was amazing on camera. And I knew.
So calm collected. Yeah.
And I knew it would be a great scene. I just was like, oh, this is emotional seppuku. Like, I was I was like, I will sacrifice my own self for this thing. And so we brought her and she was great. And yet, like, she, you know, like, our family's been going through some stuff in the past few years. Like, also, no kids live at home, so she's not making rice every day. You know, it's not, she's a little out of practice. And so she put the rice on, and, like, she put it on so low. And I was like, Mom, are you sure it's supposed to be this low? And I kept trying to hint, like, let's turn it up a little. And she's like, no, it has to be really, really, really low. And then in the end, it was too low, and we actually had to put it back in the pot. And we were running out of daylight, and it was this whole thing. And so when we went to go flip it out, I could tell it wasn't as, like, tight as it could have or should have been. And so we flipped it out, and a little piece of it broke. And I immediately, you know, again, I had that thought, that production head, where I'm like, well, we're not going to be able to do it again. Like, this is it, you know, and this thing. But even in that moment, I was like, well, sometimes it breaks, you know? Like,
the tahdig.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. I mean, that the crispy rice and... I mean, because one knows watching that segment that you learned all that from her. And probably once you already knew it really well, maybe better than her, she still had to coach you.
Oh, 100%.
A million times and tell you what you were doing wrong.
Totally. I mean, yeah. And people are always like, oh, you guys must have such a fun time cooking together. I was like, no, she just cooks. Like, I can't put myself through the turmoil of cooking in the kitchen with her. And she can cook way more delicious Persian food than I can, you know? And it's the taste of my childhood. It's what it's like gives her pleasure to cook for me, and it gives me pleasure to not have to cook with her.
So the Heat episode, which takes place, part of it takes place at Chez Panisse, where you began your cooking career. And there's a great scene where you're grilling steaks over a coal fire with head chef Amy Densler. Again, this totally refreshing visual to see you and a woman of a certain age, not a youngster, running the kitchen. And in so many food shows where there is fire and meat involved, it's usually a couple bearded men in plaid shirts. Was that typical of being at Chez Panisse, the female?
Absolutely. And also, I really did learn how to grill steak from Amy Densler. So to me, I was like, oh, we're going there. We're going to do this, you know. And obviously, somewhere in the back of my mind, I understood what a subversive kind of image it is to put that on TV. But I think for me, the watching women and coming up alongside women in the kitchen who are incredibly skilled has been one of the great privileges and joys of my cooking career, to see girls not being afraid of fire, not only not being afraid of it, but like being able to control it. And I am very clear that I'm not the best chef in the world or even the best cook. And there are so many women in my community and men who are way better cooks than I am. And so it's a dream for me to get to let the world see that, you know. And Amy Dentzler is one of the most elegant, soft-spoken, talented, and under-recognized cooks in this country. And to give her like 3 minutes of airtime was a great pleasure. You know, she was like a big sister to me in the kitchen, and in what was never a very like macho kitchen, but obviously for a 19-year-old was a really intimidating place to be. She always made space for me, and so this was a way for me to honor her.
And I just want to talk for a minute about, because we're talking about like women and strength in a certain way. One of the things that I love the most in the show is that sprinkled throughout these visits to destinations, there are instructional parts that take place in your home. And
or my quote-unquote home.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yes, your quote-unquote home. Somebody's beautiful home. And your hands, the image of watching you make food, I think... The scars.
So many scars, yeah.
And I just think it's, it was very meaningful to me.
Thank you.
I'm tearing up.
No, thank you. Multiple people have mentioned that. And I think I love my hands. You know, I love the scars. Like, they all tell a different story. And I remember, like, they all mean something in my birthmark. And
but it's also the competency, because whenever people talk about like minimum wage or immigrant issues, they always refer to unskilled labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we do in the kitchen, even it is so skilled once you achieve a facility.
Absolutely.
And so to watch you just transform things with your hand in a very sure way is really wonderful.
Thank you. That's really nice to hear. I mean, yeah, I don't know what else to say. I feel sometimes, also it's this, I'm going through my own weird, I'm in a weird position and transformation.
What is it? I was going to ask you, what are you going to do next? Do you immediately go to season two? Or are you going to write another book where you invent four other flavors?
I need a rest. That's like the first thing I know I need to do is like, I've been sprinting salt, fat, acid, heat for 6 years. So I need a break. I need to figure out, I need to make choices from a place of clarity rather than like, because it's also amazing because everyone's like, I got an email the other day. I was like, come to Transylvania. I was like, I got to go to Transylvania. Like, like, you know, like, and I was like.
They make good salami there.
I know. I mean, all these amazing opportunities, but I also know myself and like, I will run myself ragged. So I'm going to take a break and I need to figure out sort of what's going to bring me the most joy. I feel like the amazing thing that I've broken through something is now I just get to do whatever I want, which is pretty lucky and pretty cool. So that's pretty awesome. But I guess in terms of the transformation that are like this weird transition that I'm referring to is I'm not exactly, it's been a lot of years since I was in a kitchen every day, but I still, if people ask me what I do, I always say cook first, even though I go to an office and I write most days. So some days I say writer, but also I don't know, now I have this other thing that I do. And I'm just trying to figure out who I am. So a lot of the time I feel very unsure as a cook, especially anytime I do sort of moonlight with other people. I'm always like, do I remember how to make ravioli? The other day I had to make something. I was making caramels. And I was like, I don't even know. You know, a recipe I've made a bajillion times. And I somehow ruined it. And I was like, well, there you go. Like,
I call myself a culinary multitasker.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah.
You're allowed to use that.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's just a dream and an honor and a pleasure to sit here with you, Evan.
I've been talking to Samin Nosrat. Her new 4-part Netflix show is Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Well, it is that time of year, apple season. After the break, we're talking about grafting apples with a fifth-generation apple grower. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. First, there was the Red Delicious. Then other varieties like Honeycrisp and Fuji came to market. Fast forward to now, and there are more than 2,500 apple varieties out there. So what does it take to create an apple that stands out?
Being an apple breeder is a very long-term business. For any apple breeders out there, keep going, because the next Honeycrisp could be coming, but it's going to take many thousands of crosses to get there.
That's Tate Matheson of Stemmelt Growers, one of the largest producers of Washington-grown apples. You know those stickers you see on apples? They invented them. Tate's family has been growing apples for five generations. Stemmelt is currently in a moment of success, having launched three new varieties since 2004, one of them nearly 20 years in the making. Can you explain why, when we talk about growing apples, we talk about grafting and not planting seeds?
All the commercial orchards that we've been growing for a number of different generations now have what they call as a rootstock. And that rootstock is a different apple tree than the sign or the top of the tree, which, you know, has the apples growing on it. And that rootstock brings out certain characteristics of the cultivar, or the apple, I should say. Some rootstocks are good for, you know, light soil or heavy soil. Some rootstocks make big trees, and some rootstocks make smaller trees. But it really allows the tree to be consistent in the orchard and easy for the farmer to manage, I guess, really. So, yeah, it's all the apples that we've ever eaten are all grown on different roots.
Because if we planted, for example, the seed that's in one individual apple, every tree that would come from those seeds would be different from one another.
Yeah, it's actually amazing. I think you mentioned that there was 2,500 different varieties, but there's really infinite amount of combinations of apple varieties and genetics. It's interesting, but the seeds inside are not the actual apple that you're eating. It's some combination there of the parent of the tree there of, let's just say, Red Delicious in this example, but whatever pollinated that flower, it's a combination of that apple plus the Red Delicious, so it's a little bit different, just kind of like we have children, you know, they're not really like the mother or the father, they're a combination thereof. So what it's done is having a rootstock really kind of allows the orchards to be all the same. It allows us also to find certain variety of apples and replicate that genetics in the orchard without a lot of variation. Now, it does vary, you know, over time. Mother Nature does throw curveballs, and so you do have, you know, changes in varieties, like Gala, for example. So there's many different strains of Gala. Some Galas are stripy and some are more blushy. And it really all came from, you know, a crossing of a couple different apples that was bred in New Zealand. And what it is as observant farmers look at their orchard, of course, they're all Gala and they're all on the same rootstock. So they all technically should be the same. But Mother Nature, the way she works, will make variations in the trees. And so what they do is they cut a little branch off of that Gala that, let's say, it's a little bit bigger, a little bit redder, a little bit sweeter, and they'll graft it onto another rootstock and see if that slight change of variation will stay true to type. And so if it is and it's stable, and then they can graft it on, and then now you have a Gala that maybe is a little bit more red and a little bit more sweet or a little bit larger. And that's how we get slight variations within each apple variety.
And when you do that, when you make a graft for a new variety, how long do you have to wait for the tree to grow and mature enough to bear fruit?
There's a number of different variables that can determine that. You know, some rootstocks are just inherently more vigorous, so it'll push the signwood or the part of the tree that's been grafted, it'll push that branch to grow faster. So you could maybe get fruit a little sooner. Other rootstocks will bring out kind of more feminine attributes of the tree, so it'll have more buds, more spur density, and it'll grow a little slower, yet could fruit a little bit earlier or more often or more consistent. And so it usually takes about 3 years before you really start to see any sort of apples come off the tree once you've grafted it onto a rootstock. And It's been placed in an orchard. Really, it's 4 years, maybe 5 years, before you start to really consider it fully cropping.
So your work requires a huge amount of patience.
Apples are what they would consider a permanent crop, and you're really kind of highlighting the fact that it is permanent. You plant it, you grow it, you really can't till it under and then start with a new crop or change over crops very quickly. So it takes a long time to do that. So you better be sure whenever you plant an apple orchard that you have one that works in your side and works in the marketplace too, yeah.
Your farm's newest apple is called Rave. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, Rave is kind of a funny apple because Rave is a Honeycrisp by Monarch. Monarch is an apple that was predominantly grown for early coloring and early summer apple. No longer really is a commercial variety, but the breeders of Rave are at University of Minnesota, and because of their climate, they needed apples that would harvest early because winter comes early in Minnesota. And so Monarch brought early traits to that genetic tree. And then Honeycrisp, they were also the breeders of Honeycrisp, and obviously that's been such a great winter. They tried to make the combination of the two, and really what's happened is Rave is just a fantastic apple that ripens early, it's resistant to sunburn, and really the best part about Rave is that it's exceedingly juicy. So it had a lot of the fracture of a Honeycrisp.
Does fracture mean that incredibly crisp mouthfeel?
Yeah, you know, the fracture, I mean, really Honeycrisp set the standard for fracture, right, or for crunch, and that is it's not hard to bite, so it doesn't hurt your teeth or your gums, but it breaks apart in your mouth. And really, the best way I can explain it is what makes a good kind of a fracture in an apple, the cells need to be large, and as you bite into them, you're kind of breaking apart the cells and then crushing them up in your mouth. And that's why Honeycrisp is such a juicy apple.
So we're kind of pie obsessed here. Tell us what your favorite pie apples are.
Pinata usually makes the best pies, and it's kind of a combination of a number of different apple varieties. Orange Cox Pippin, which is a very old one. Duchess of Oldenburg, which is an ancient apple that really hasn't really exist anymore in the commercial market. And Golden Delicious, which is also an excellent pie making apple. And so it has a dense texture. And then as it cooks, it actually keeps that flavor and kind of keeps that kind of apple flavor to it. And I think that's the one thing that we really have to be worried about as we're breeding new apples. We're not thinking of the culinary aspects of the fruit. We're really just thinking of the out-of-hand aspects of it. So pinata, for sure, I think is the best apple for any sort of baking. Because of the way people are, you know, I've always eaten apples. Of course, they eat them kind of as snacks. That's really kind of been the segment that the apple breeding and the apple selection has gone towards, and that is just what actually has the best mouthfeel and what actually are people going to want to kind of keep biting into. Am I making sense how we're choosing these apples?
And I have to say that as a cook who knows a lot of other cooks, a lot of us are sort of starting to bemoan the fact that apples have become less dense because denser varieties are better for cooking.
Yeah, I totally agree. I just got to convince all these breeders all over the world that, you know, we need to have some good cooking apples, and you know they're gonna tell me, you know, one out of every 10,000 apples really even has a snowflake's chance of making it. And so, I mean, I don't think they're that focused on it. I wish they were.
Thank you so much, Tate.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
That's Tate Matheson of Stem Oak Growers. He's a fifth-generation apple grower in Washington State. One of the best fall family activities here in Southern California is going to pick apples. So we have some suggestions for you pick apple experiences. Go to our blog at blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Continuing our focus on fall fruits, we're turning it over to Laura Avery at the Farmers Market.
It is fall, and we turn to fall colors, mainly orange. There's a lot of orange here at the market. We've got persimmons, and we've got the fall melons. I'm talking right now with Uli Nasibova, who has Gelateria Uli, located downtown in the Spring Arcade building, a beautiful glass-enclosed three-story arcade. If you haven't seen it, it is worth a trip. Uli is standing here holding a persimmon in one hand and a lemon guava in the other hand, getting her game on here to talk to us about how she's inspired by the farmer's market and by the flavors. So, Uli, what is your jam today?
My jam is going to be, so today I'm buying persimmons, yellow strawberry guavas, pomegranates, and I'm also going to roam around and see what else is good. The beauty of having your own spot and not a set schedule, so to speak, is I can get inspired by something on the spot and turn it into a flavor to put into the case tomorrow.
Because you are the head chef, you make all the decisions, and you can come here and then literally transform it into a gelato in 24 hours.
Yes. Sometimes I need to create a brand new recipe I've never made before. So that might take me a couple of days of R&D, just trying things out. But for the most part, yes. Call the shots.
So what is it about gelato that makes it better than or different than what we call ice cream?
Very interesting question, because I am not Italian. I'm not originally from Italy. But I really appreciate the Italian way of making ice cream. Gelato and ice cream have the exact same ingredients, milk, cream, sugar, and then whatever you're flavoring it with. However, gelato has different proportions and different amount of air whipped into it during production, which, in my opinion, makes it a better product.
So it has less air than regular ice cream?
Yes. Basically, I have a machine that churns the ice cream, the gelato, as it's freezing it. And you can control the speed of the blades, and you can control the amount of air or overrun that gets incorporated into your ice cream gelato. But the most important thing that I'm trying to figure out is, well, what is the fruit that I'm working with? How much acidity, how much sweetness, how ripe it is? How much sugar am I going to be adding? How much water, milk, cream? The texture has to be smooth. I'm very big on texture. So my biggest thing is I don't have gimmicky flavors. I have very simple flavors that represent the product that they're made from. So if you come to my store, you will not necessarily find a flavor that has 16 ingredients. Mm-hmm. It will be one thing, but it will not only represent the flavor that I'm making, but I will personally come and pick the best one that I think I can find and then try to do it justice.
And that ripe persimmon you're holding in your hand that looks like a big fat handful of custard, mm-hmm, right now as it's, yeah, sitting there, how do you treat that? And are you going to add anything to it?
Yes, very little bit. So my persimmon is going to be a sorbet. And that's because I've made persimmon gelato, which is milk-based, before. But I prefer making sorbets. I use a lot more fruit when I make a sorbet as opposed to a dairy-based recipe. And there's going to be more of that persimmon flavor coming through. So you will feel as if you're biting into a beautiful ripe persimmon, but it's going to be frozen. It's going to have probably the same perfect texture you see right now. So that's where my recipe making skills are put to test. How do I translate the texture while using all natural ingredients? And I talked about not having very many ingredients. I usually have two or less. So the other ingredient that I think goes really well with persimmon is almonds.
Oh, yes. Like toasted almonds or,
yes,
just that almond essence? That sort
no,
of,
toasted, yeah, toasted almonds.
Incorporated into the sorbet?
Persimmon sorbet. So the flavor is persimmon sorbet with toasted almonds.
All right, Uli. Well, this has been just, I only wish we had samples right now, but we'll have to come downtown.
You're just going to have to come, please, and I'll treat you to samples galore.
Well, I just want to see this beautiful space, and I want to see your case and try everything. So thank you so much for being here at the market and making the beautiful sorbets and gelato that you do.
Of course.
That was Uli Nasibova. She is the chef owner of Gelateria Uli, and she's down at the Spring Arcade building, and she's also got a shop on West 3rd and Crescent Heights. She is an inspired gelatoista. Okay, now we're visiting with Jeff Rieger, who has a farm that's called Penryn Orchard Specialties, located in Penryn. And Jeff, you have
Beautiful Penryn. Beautiful Penryn.
Now, you grow not only Hachia persimmons, but other varieties of persimmons. And what we talked about with Chef Uli was her Hachia persimmon sorbet. And that's a super soft, ripe persimmon. How do all persimmons grow at the same rate, at the same time of year? Is it harvest time now? When's the best season for persimmons?
Yes, no, maybe, and I'm not sure.
Okay.
Is that right? No. All levity aside, I grow 8 varieties of persimmons. They do not all come in at the same time. I start out with the Surinoco. The vernacular on that is the chocolate persimmon, which we are selling out of today. The next one is the maru, which is the cinnamon. And following that, close on its heels, is the hyakume. Those are all pollination variant, non-astringent. Okay. So those three varieties you can eat hard or soft. Now the hachia, and also its companion, the tamapan, which I grow, we call that the mango persimmon. Those are pollination constant astringent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you got to wait for them to be dead soft, the hachia, and I'd like to see your ice cream chef try the tamapan, which we call the mango persimmon, in her ice cream. It handles just like the hachia, except that its skin is not papery thin when it's soft, so it's much easier to handle and you don't get cracks, which then can mold. Mm-hmm. And of course, both those persimmons, you get them soft and you can't eat them right away, just freeze them. You know, moosh them up, put them in a quart and freeze them, and they'll be fine.
Now, your persimmons, like a lot of these fruit farmers that we have, you leave them on the tree, or do you pick them, season them, let them sit around for a while, rest, condition, whatever, before you bring them in, or are they right off the tree?
They're essentially right off the tree.
They don't go into a cold storage or anything?
Well, you know, it depends on the time of the pick and the prescribed usage. If I were selling persimmons to your ice cream chef, well, she's going to want them softer, so I'm probably not going to cool them for her, mm-hmm. because she's going to want them to get soft so she can use them, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So that's something that you can do at a farmer's market that you can't necessarily do at, you know, at Safeway or Save Mart or something, where they can tell me what they're going to use it for and I can customize it to the greatest of my ability.
Literally customize when you harvest it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, people make an order. I pick the fruit right off the tree. I can see their face, and I'm thinking about them when I'm out there working hard.
You must see little faces on all your fruit. You see the little face smiling at you.
What I see is a lot of plant bugs. Yeah, plant bugs talking to me and throwing things at me. Yeah. Absolutely. I see a little face.
So, Jeff, we are going to be enjoying your other varieties of persimmons.
Yes.
You also have some lovely pears, and Laurence makes jams, and you have lots and lots of goodies, Penryn Orchard specialties, and you're here at the Wednesday Market. You, your smiling face, your wonderful staff. And we will come visit, and we'll taste those chocolate and cinnamon and other persimmons that you have.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Jeff. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
After the break, we're talking about why porridge might be one of the most craveable dishes of the year. Stick around. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. What words come to mind when you think about a bowl of porridge? Maybe humble, simple, or even bland? Not to Chef Min Pham. Her restaurant, Porridge and Puffs, recently opened in historic Filipino town after several years as an on-again, off-again pop-up. In 2014, Jonathan Gold visited her pop-up and came away raving about her carefully composed porridge bowls brimming with flavor.
If it were possible to hand-knit a restaurant from organic wool and put it up for sale on Etsy, it would probably be a lot like Porridge and Puffs.
I recently had lunch there during their soft opening with my friend Zach Brooks. Zach's the general manager of Smorgasburg LA. That was a pretty stunning lunch, right?
It was beautiful.
When you say to somebody, we're going to go somewhere and we're going to have porridge, that usually means, you know, a bowl of kind of liquidy, very, very well-cooked rice with some little bit of condiments on top.
Yeah, and I think if you've eaten porridge around town, right, whether it's Thai porridge at Siam Sunset or you've been to Mountain, the place in Koreatown that does a great version, you have this vision of what porridge is. And either, you know, you grew up eating it and it evokes these feelings of home and comfort, you know, or you're someone like me who didn't grow up eating it. And I feel like Porridge and Puffs is that place that is for both of those people.
What Min is doing is there's something very artful about it. First of all, you walk into that space and it's a beautiful, simple space where every decision has been very carefully made. It's got this high ceiling. It's a lot of light wood. It feels really like you can breathe and the plates are so beautifully composed. You have the menu in front of you. Maybe you could just read the description of one of them just to give folks an idea of all the layers.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite one right now is the yaki miso and sausage, which is grilled black-eyed pea miso with K&K ranch nectarines, ginger and aromatics, And then there's the numbing spice braised pork sausage, fennel and black bean sauce. And then you have the rose, geranium, onion, and celery pickles, edible flowers. And then at the end, it says negi rice porridge, which is the whole bottom part.
Let's hear a bit from Min.
I grew up, my parents are Vietnamese, so we only had porridge on two occasions. One of them was the day after Thanksgiving, when you had a huge ham bone and a turkey bone, you got the day after Thanksgiving porridge. And the other one is usually a sad occasion where you're sick and you're being quarantined from everyone else. I wanted porridge to be more celebrated in its own thing rather than a remedy for being sick or the day after. So I want to celebrate it every day.
She's fascinating, Min Phan. I mean, I can't wait to see once she stretches out, once there's more time. Although apparently she's going to be doing a brunch now, and she's going to do something called The Gold in honor of our friend.
There's a few places that have opened in the past few months that just make you think of Jonathan. When you're there, when you heard about it, when you eat, you know, just thinking like, he would have loved this. It was someone that he championed who now gets to have their fully formed, beautiful restaurant, partly because of him, partly for him. And the fact that she honors him with this dish, which is a basically deconstructed version of one of her porridge bowls in multiple courses, it sounds like.
She says it's a curated palette ready for you to compose your perfect bites, because Jonathan used to always talk about that, how much he loved food, that flavors would jostle up against each other and every single bite was different. So we've been talking about the porridge. What about the puffs?
Traditional congee, you know, always comes with a donut of some kind. And Min's are her version of the beignet, I think. And then it has this, like, great, like, chewy consistency.
It's a mochi beignet.
It's not bad. It is not bad.
I've been talking with Zach Brooks, general manager of Smorgasburg LA, about porridge and puffs in historic Filipino town. Visit porridgeandpuffs.com for hours. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, please tell a friend and leave us a great review if you loved the show. Many thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.